Case number 13-7100, Peter George O. Diabo, Appellant v. Republic of Kenya, a foreign state et al. Mr. Lusby for the appellant, Mr. Ackerman for the appellee.
Good
morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Pardon me while I set my bench. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Ludwig on behalf of the appellant Peter O. Diabo, who's in the courtroom with us today, along with my co-counsel Tom Kire. This case involves an action brought by Mr. O. Diabo, a bank auditor turned whistleblower, whose information led to the closure of Charterhouse Bank. Mr. O. Diabo, facing the vendetta of senior officials affected, was referred by the Kenyan Human Rights Commission for asylum to the United States. Mr. Odiambo brings this suit, which you cannot safely bring in Kenya, for breach of contract, of a reward contract against the Appellees, Republic of Kenya, its Ministry of Finance, and its Revenue Authority, which Kenya has continued to pay to him while in the United States. Odiambo is a credit to both the United States, as reflected in Ambassador Renneberger's letter quoted at page 5 of our brief, as well as to Kenya, having brought in or identified potential tax evasion estimated by their central bank.
Is Mr. Odiano a citizen of the United States?
He is a citizen. He's currently a citizen. Of 2 to 3 billion Kenyan shillings, and for his effort, his personal dislocation and risk to his life, he's been rewarded with token annual payments in 2004, 05, 06, 07, and 09, the last two received in the United States, totaling about $23,000. He doesn't know the amount owed because Kenya won't say, except for one misrepresentation it directed to him in 2007, received in the United States, with respect to one large tax evader, which was understated, as he found out, only last May, 2013, by a factor of 20, millions of U.S. dollars. This is newly discovered evidence raised on a Rule 59 motion and in a proposed Second Amendment complaint. Now, rather than pay Mr. Odiambo on his simple contract and not fraud, his specific performance and other claims, Kenya has advanced much the same bevy of arguments that this court found unpersuasive in a recent decision, DiCeppo versus Republic of Hungary. DiCeppo found that Hungary's promise to return art to the United States, knowing that its owners were in the United States.
Knowing, right? It really emphasized the word new.
Yes. And the record is clear on the uncontroverted allegations and the evidence that, on motion to dismiss, has not been rebutted or even denied by Kenya. Kenya knew that Mr. Odiambo was first in Tanzania, and which it established, as the record shows, before it would release the payment to its intermediary, Mr. Weru.
And how did they pay him when he was in Tanzania?
Excuse me?
How did they pay him when he was in Tanzania? They didn't pay him in Tanzania, did they?
No, they did, in effect, what they could have done by going to the FedEx office in Nairobi by directing payment to him in Kenya. And they did that twice more in the United States.
So the payments in the United States, how were those made?
By the same method, by the intermediary that Kenya itself had proposed back at the outset of the...
Who received the funds in Kenya and then transmitted them to...
No, to be picked up by Mr. Weru, an intermediary, who was, as the court found, at the very least...
Picked up where?
picked up in Kenya.
In Kenya.
Yes. With the intent to direct them to the United States, no different than DeCepel, where the art, which was under a bailment obligation, a specific performance, would be collected in Hungary at various museums.
Does it make a difference that what was owed in DeCepel was paintings and there was a... the legal claim was one for specific performance, and here what was owed was cash? Does that make a difference legally?
We don't think so, and moreover, that question is premised on the Weltover notion of a failure to pay or wire funds to a bank account in the United States. In Weltover, the Supreme Court rejected, and let me quote, we reject the notion that the direct effects requirements cannot be satisfied where plaintiffs are all foreign with no other connections to the U.S. The principal rationale of the court below, as emphasized by Kenya, are the Kenyan origins of this case. But that has nothing to do with the fact that there was an obligation with knowledge of his location to pay him.
But a promise to pay wherever you might be, our cases said, Peterson and Goodman say that's not good enough to get over the third prong.
I think what they say is that a unilateral act by the plaintiff is insufficient. The plaintiff, to survive a motion to dismiss, must show that there was consent to pay and to modify the contract, and that's the Adler case, which Kenya has no response to, or a course of practice, dealing. And that's the distinction between this case and...
Well, the cases, those two cases, Peterson and Goodman, really relied on the fact that there wasn't a U.S. location designated in the contract. In fact, in Goodman, that's why Judge Wald wrote separately, because she didn't agree with that. But the opinion we have to follow required that the United States be designated in the contract.
Well, it... I would submit that DeCepel is governing authority that revises that understanding and basically adopts Judge Wald's concurrence. You also have a course of dealing. You'd have to just write out of the facts that they actually continue to issue payments, not just what occurred in the first 2 years, but for the next 5 years to the United States. And unlike Walter,
well, way to square them, the author of DeCepel's also on the Peterson case, a way to square them seems to be if the agreements designate the United States or if it's specific performance for someone you know is in the United States. Those are two ways to get around it. We don't have either of those two things here.
Well, we would submit most certainly we do have the second one. Mm-hmm. They knew he was in the United States, and they dealt with him for 5 years in the United States. They knew where to convey a misrepresentation as to the quantum recovered of taxes to him in the United States in 2007. There were meetings, several meetings in the United States. There was ongoing written and telephone communication.
I guess the tricky part of this is I think, and maybe this is unclear, that the cases emphasize the time of the contract formation, what the contemplation of the parties was in terms of the location of where they were.
Adler, I think, responds to that issue, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. In your first amended complaint, what allegations did
Adler's
you make?
Adler's not a case of this court, though.
It's a Ninth Circuit case, yeah. Your Honor. But the Congress intended that the act be construed uniformly by the circuits.
What were the allegations you made in the first amended complaint about contract formation?
Well, the formation is the formation, but in terms of the place of payment.
What connection it had to do with the United States?
That the intent was of the parties to pay Mr. Odhiambo where located.
Yeah, and that's not enough. So don't you have to allege that that contract was somehow modified?
Well, that allegation
you
was...
You did that in response to the motion to dismiss, but it's not in your complaint.
I believe it's in the First Amendment complaint as well.
But again,
we're talking about merely a Weltover situation, which is just the mere requirement to pay an account in the U.S. This has far more. There are actual contacts with the United States. Weltover involved not a single payment made to the United States or any other contact. This case involves two payments that were directed to the United States, as well as numerous contacts over the course of 5 years. Moreover, this case clearly involves Clause 2, whereby there was a single act or omission in the United States.
Were the payments referenced in the complaint, the two payments in the United States?
In the Second Amendment complaint, they were.
In the Second Amendment complaint, not in the First Amendment complaint.
Yes. And cases should be decided.
So in the Second Amendment complaint, we would have to decide that under the 59E analysis, right?
Yes, and you get there quite simply because the court, through numerous errors below, by fundamentally reversing the FSIA burden of proof, shifting the ultimate burden from Kenya, whose affirmative defense it was, to Mr. Odhiambo, thoroughly prejudiced.
Can you explain a little bit more about that? I'm not sure that I see how the district judge shifted the burden. There's a burden, as I understand it, on a 12B1 to look at the allegations of the complaint. And the defense has been raised in the 12B1 motion. And then you look at the allegations of the complaint and see whether, for example, if we're looking under the third alternative exception, we're looking at direct effect. Are there allegations here of direct effect in the United States? Is that shifting the burden? And then once there's an allegation, then the defense would have to put it in issue at the summary judgment stage, or the trial judge, I suppose, could hold a hearing if there were factual disputes on that. But where's the burden shift that took place here, the impermissible burden shift?
Well, this case could have been filed as a diversity action or filed in state court. And if the foreign state waives its sovereign immunity, it is jurisdiction, regardless of what's in the allegation of the complaint.
Right, but apart from waiver, if we're looking, for example, at the direct effect prong, was there an impermissible burden placed on Mr. Odhiambo?
Absolutely. The problem here is the ultimate burden. The ultimate burden of persuasion under Rule 12b-1 rests with the plaintiff, not in an FSIA context, because it's an affirmative defense that's waivable. It's clear under the Act. Every circuit, as we cite, as pointed out recently by the First Circuit in Universal Trading, recognizes that, including the D.C. Circuit. It's a red herring, absolutely, for them to argue that somehow Bell Helicopter changes the requirement that the foreign state bear the ultimate burden of persuasion. That's the first fundamental error. There are other errors. The court decided issues on a motion to dismiss.
I'm just not sure I understand the notion that the defendant has put the defense in issue, and then the court looks at the allegations of the complaint and takes the arguments in the brief. There isn't really, at the complaint stage, a burden of persuasion, is there? It's just a burden of coming forward and putting it in issue, and then what do we look at to see whether there's a potential claim here? We look at it in Rule 12.
There is on jurisdictional fact. There is a burden of persuasion. And it goes to jurisdictional facts, such as the intent to pay Mr. Odhiambo, where located in the United States, or whether to use the intermediary for conveying payments and misrepresentations of Mr. Odhiambo. Those answers are nowhere found in their briefs. And if they have answers to what their actual position is, where they put in no affirmative evidence on their affirmative burden, we'd like to hear that today. In addition, nowhere have they answered what substantial contact means. Substantial contact clearly means minimum contacts, as set forth in decisions of the Supreme Court before and after the 1976 enactment of FSIA.
I'm just trying to get your position on this. So the district court erred because, in fact, there were payments to Mr. Odhiambo in the United States, and they did not deny that?
They did not deny intending those payments to be received as they were in the United States, nor did they deny at all that they intended to convey a misrepresentation, a gross misrepresentation, as to the taxes collected with respect to Nakumat Holding, as set forth in our brief. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time and also ask Kenya, however, if it has an answer to what substantial contact means for purposes of Clause 1, we'd like to hear it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning. us now.
May it please the Court, David Ackerman on behalf of the appellees. I think the Court's questions hit on a number of, frankly, what are the key issues in this case and the questions that demonstrate that the appellant's claims do not fall within any of the exceptions to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. Rather, this is a uniquely Kenyan dispute. It involves a contract that appellant alleges was offered in Kenya, an acceptance that occurred in Kenya.
But clearly, Kenya has known where he is for the last several years, and they've been paying him here. They've been meeting with him here. Why is that not a direct effect in the United States?
I would disagree, just to take those
sure,
in order.
Yeah.
I would disagree that Kenya has been paying Mr. Appellant in the United States.
But they know where he is, right? They've known where he is for some time. They've met with him here.
They have known that he was in the United States.
They paid him, right?
They issued payments in Kenya to a person who Mr. Odhiambo authorized by letter to accept the payments on his behalf.
And they knew where it was headed, right? I mean, they
refused to issue any payments outside of Kenya.
Perhaps because they didn't want to be subject to suit in the United States under the third exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
That could be one reason, yes.
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt.
But that is what the case law holds. Yeah. Is the cases such as Goodman Holdings and Peterson hold that where the payment could have been made anywhere but was not required to be
this
made.
This case
in
is
the
a
United
little
States.
Different from Peterson and from Goodman, isn't it? Here you have a situation where the plaintiff entered into a contract with the government of Kenya. And because of that, and there's no question that it's only because of that, his life was threatened, and the government of Kenya facilitated him becoming a refugee in the United States, and he is a refugee in the United States. There's no contention that he should just go and sue in Kenya and get his money. There's no risk here that he's been forum shopping around the world, that he just liked the idea of suing them in Kenya. This is quite distinct, isn't it, from Goodman?
Your Honor, certainly there was no allegation in Peterson that the plaintiff was a refugee, but I would also say that under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, I don't think there is an exception for a situation where a country has assisted in the relocation of a national to another country.
But the question whether Kenya knew where Mr. Odhiambo was is relevant under our precedence under DCEFL, for example.
I don't think so. I don't think it's dispositive. It may be relevant, but I don't believe it's dispositive. DCEFL is distinguishable because in DCEFL, the allegation was that there was a bailment contract, that the Republic of Hungary was holding specific stolen art items that had belonged to the family as a bailment, and therefore was required to return those specific items to the United States.
Why does that make a difference?
Because here, I think there's a difference between tangible items and between cash.
What?
That's how
why,
you...
Why, for purposes of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, does that make a difference? Something of value is being deprived that I'm entitled to under a contract, whether it's a bailment contract or a reward for information contract. It's a contract, and it's a commercial contract of a kind that non-governmental entities enter into. I'm in the United States, suffering a loss of a thing of value to me.
It makes a difference, Your Honor, because the purpose of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is to prevent plaintiffs from forum shopping, to prevent plaintiffs from moving to the United States and then demanding payment there. Certainly, I understand.
I think, as Judge Pillard has pointed out in her question, that certainly doesn't describe this case, right?
I'm not asserting that appellant was forum shopping in this case. Okay. However, if you look at the text of the statute, there is not an exception that states where a citizen is relocated as a refugee, it may assert any claim against the foreign government. Appellant's claims still have to fit into one of the listed exceptions.
And we're talking about the direct effects exception, right?
Yes. Yes, we are.
We have a plaintiff who's in the United States being paid money that's going to get to him here and is meeting with Kenyan officials here? Why does the breach of contract not have a direct effect on the United States?
Well, to address each of those in turn, yeah. The payment of money is not a direct effect in the United States under Peterson and under Goodman Holdings because it could have been paid anywhere.
That's a little odd. And I mean, when you think about that, play that out in the circumstances of this case, that the government puts out a general offer for, it's going to give you a reward if you come up with information. And under your reading, then in order to be sure you're going to get money, you have to think, well, if I give them the information, they'll probably leak it, and then I'll probably have to become a refugee. And where am I likely to become a refugee? Well, the United States is a good humanitarian country. Let's write that in. Really?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that my argument is taking that issue that far. I think what you have here is a situation where the Kenyan government had a statute authorizing an award that it advertised in Kenya to Kenyan citizens and then stated to its citizens it would make the payments in Kenyan shillings in Kenya, but not outside of Kenya. And in those circumstances, the government of Kenya itself has not evidenced any intent to, even if you were to adopt some personal jurisdiction paradigm, which I don't think which we don't think is applicable here, the government of Kenya has not taken any action to avail itself of the protections of the United States or to avail itself of the United States courts.
The line seems to be, the case law we have to figure out here, the line seems to be a pay wherever you are is not good enough. Pay when you know at the time of the contract that the other parties in the United States is good enough.
I don't know if that's quite the line, and the reason is because in the Peterson case, Peterson was a United States plaintiff who had worked in Saudi Arabia and then relocated back to the United States.
It was alleged and known that the person would go back to the United States, I guess, right?
That's yes,
the
point. Yes. It involved what I think were the Saudi Arabian equivalent of Social Security payments made to foreign workers and the refund of those payments.
Right. But Peterson's also different. Didn't he do the work in Saudi Arabia? He accrued the right in Saudi Arabia. There's no real issue about whether he could have gone to Saudi Arabia and recovered, is there? As there is in this case.
I think the fact that Peterson did the work in Saudi Arabia is equivalent to this case because appellant provided the tax information to the Kenyan government while he was in Kenya. Those two facts are equal. I'm not sure whether there was any allegation in Peterson of whether Mr. Peterson was available to go or whether there was an ability to litigate that action in Saudi Arabia. But I think if you look at the case of Saudi Arabia v. Nelson, where the claim is that the government tortured the plaintiff while he was in Saudi Arabia, and the Supreme Court held that that did not state a claim under any of the commercial activities exceptions.
Okay, but so Peterson was never paid in the United States. He received his refund in Saudi Arabia. He deposited it in a Saudi bank. The entire transaction occurred outside the United States. He could have moved to any country. So he was someone who was, unlike the plaintiff in this case, known to be going to the United States. In fact, Kenya had facilitated him coming to the United States, and he really didn't have a practical choice to go and recover his money. Anyway, Peterson, the whole point of it is, here's somebody who's chosen to work there and deals with the Social Security system in Saudi Arabia like any other worker.
I understand the distinction that you were making, but I don't believe the mere placement of a person in the United States would be enough to constitute a direct effect under the court's precedent.
I agree with you on that.
Yes.
Why not have a refugee exception?
I think that's a question for Congress, Your Honor. And perhaps that is something that Congress may want to address. But under this statute, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, there's certainly, I don't believe, an exception for claims made by refugees against foreign governments. Frankly, I think it might be a difficult exception to administer. But the other aspect.
I think it's something Congress contemplated, probably didn't contemplate.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
When you were saying mere placement in the United States, I do think it makes a difference for the direct effect exception if the foreign government at issue has placed the individual in the United States. That does make a difference. And, in fact, isn't that part of the atmospherics of the Hungary case, the DeSepel case, that these are individuals who were their own sovereign was unwilling or unable to protect them, and similarly here in Kenya, it was not really an option for Mr. Odhiambo to remain and pursue his claim in Kenya.
But again, I think the DeSepel case is predicated on the fact that there was specific performance required in the United States. There is nothing in this case.
Why does that make a difference? The specific performance in DeSepel wasn't actually required in the United States. Weren't some of the kin in that case and settled in Italy or if they were in Spain? There were a few different countries. There wasn't anything. I mean, in fact, the bailment contract was constructive. It was just something that the court said under the circumstances existed as a matter of law. So there wasn't anything written in that contract that required that the paintings specifically be delivered to the United States, was there?
Well, that was the allegation, and that was the claim. In the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act analysis, you're focusing on the claim that is alleged. And the claim is, in the DeSepel case, was that was based upon a bailment contract. And I think that's what the court was looking at in DeSepel. If the family members had been located in Italy or Spain, I do not believe there would have been an action under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act in the United States court. To address the second half of your question, Judge Griffith, which dealt with the later meetings with appellant that occurred in the United States, those meetings, first of all, are not the commercial activity that the claim is based upon. When you look at the language of the statute, there are three prongs of the commercial activity exception. It's based upon commercial activity performed in the United States, and the commercial activity here is the offer and acceptance of the contract, which we contend all occurred in Kenya. The second exception would be based upon an act performed in the United States in connection with a commercial activity elsewhere. Now, as the court below found, and correctly so, the breach of contract claims are not based upon meetings in the United States. What those claims in the First Amended complaint are based upon are the offer and acceptance and performance that occurred in Kenya. The third exception, again, would be an act based upon an act performed outside the United States that causes direct effects in the United States. Here, Your Honor, there are several cases. The cases that appellants have cited to rely on direct effects dealt with contracts, again, like DeSepel, like the contract in Cruise Connections, that had direct and immediate financial consequences to the United States. Rather, this case is closer to the situation in the second Guevara decision. The second Guevara decision in which the 11th Circuit determined that mere contact with an individual who, like appellant, had provided information in exchange for a reward were not sufficient to meet the direct effects.
Why is this not like Cruise Connections, just money?
Because Cruise Connections had specific subcontracts that required activity to occur in the United States. There was a contract that would have required a cruise ship to travel through U.S. waters. There was millions of dollars in subcontracts with U.S.-based cruise lines.
This corporation had a bunch of other contracts it had to continue to do to survive, unlike an individual who comes to the United States and would not be having any interaction with United States commerce?
No, I don't think that's the distinction, but I think what it is that there were direct contractual obligations in the United States that were at issue in Cruise Connections. My time is getting short.
The Adler case in the Ninth Circuit, if we followed that, you would lose, right, on direct effect?
I don't agree. And the reason why, and I pulled out the Adler case.
Because it read the silence there in favor of jurisdiction, in essence, because nothing there prohibited the person from selecting payment in the United States, and that was good enough for the Ninth Circuit.
Your Honor, let me just quickly read to you the portion of the Adler case that
What page are you on?
And I am on page 729 of the Adler opinion.
Okay, I was on 727, but...
Okay, at 729, the terms of the agreement permitted Adler to designate a non-Nigerian bank as the place of payment without limitation. He chose a New York bank. Nigeria presented no evidence that such a designation was prohibited by the agreement.
Yeah, if we fall out here, you lose, I think.
I don't think so. Kenya has refused to pay appellant outside of Kenya. It has required appellant to secure an intermediary and pick up the checks made in Kenyan shillings within Kenya.
And take them.
You're not actually alleging that Mr. Odhiambo should and could sue in Kenya, are you? Or asserting?
Our defense here is that the claim cannot be made in the United States. Perhaps it should be made in Kenya.
That would be challenging, right?
I think it might be.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing the last point about refusal, if you look at the record regarding the alleged refusal, it is only the initial requirement that the intermediary in July 2004 or 2006, Mr. Odhiambo had just departed Kenya or was about to depart Kenya, had approached the KRA for payment, and they wouldn't release the payment until they had written authorization from Mr. Odhiambo himself. So the, quote, refusal was not to pay Mr. Odhiambo or to require that payment occur only in Kenya, but they wanted authorization in writing from Mr. Odhiambo, which continued to occur. And moreover, the requirement not to pay in Kenya would have to be in the contract itself or the enabling statute. That doesn't exist. So if the refusal he may be referring to is the breach.
What about the context, the fact that he starts saying that the contacts that occurred in the United States are not actually material to the breach of the contract? And that those are the type of contacts we're supposed to look at.
They clearly fall within Cruz Connections. Now, I'd like to address an issue hiding in plain sight here. Cruz Connections really should have been a Clause 1 case. But because of this court's decision 30 years ago in Maritime International, suggesting that substantial contact must be more than minimum contact, even this circuit has refrained from really deciding. That term has not been decided for 37 years. And I'd like to suggest something to the court, in addition to what's in our brief, that the phrase out of McGee.
Do you get to do that?
Well it's in the McGee decision, and it's in our brief.
But you just said in addition that wasn't in our brief. I'm sorry.
I misspoke, Your Honor.
Then you do get to do that.
Yes. The Clause 1, as read in conjunction with the 1603E definition of substantial contact or commercial activity, reads, the action must be based upon a commercial activity having substantial contact with the United States. If you go back to the McGee decision, Pin cited in the legislative history, the authoritative House report, it reads, there the, quote, suit was based upon a contract which had a substantial connection with that state. If you merely replace contract with commercial activity and state with United States, you have the same phrase. So not only is the term, which is settled in McGee and Hansa before FSIA, and continued to be settled in Burger King and Asahi, which equated substantial connection with minimum contacts, but the entire sentence, all of Clause 1, comes right out of McGee. And unfortunately, in Maritime International, in a footnote, the court not only suggested that substantial must be more than minimum in dicta, it went on to discredit the House report's reference to having base FSIA or modeled on the D.C. long-arm statute, which was also enacted by Congress. If you look at Clause 1, it's a transacting business provision. Clause 2 is a single act or omission long-arm statute. Clause 3 is effects jurisdiction.
On the direct effects, can I ask you just on the Ninth Circuit's framing in Adler, which you rely on versus our court, I see the subtle distinction between what the Ninth Circuit's done and what this court has done to come into play really in a case like this, which is where the contract essentially or the offer essentially says we'll pay you wherever. Our court seems to say not good enough, whereas the Ninth Circuit said good enough. And when I say our court, I mean Peterson and Goodman Holdings. The Ninth Circuit in Adler reads that silence differently. And I guess you could go back to DeSepul, but that's where you knew it's not pay you wherever, at least as the court framed it. It was knowing that you were in the United States.
This court in Goodman and Peterson were not presented with facts even remotely like this case. In Peterson, yes, it was a Saudi U.S. worker who happened to go back to the United States. But the Saudis did not pay him either at a transit point in Tanzania or in the United States, unlike this case. Judge Wall did refer to a course of dealing, which is the bridge to DeSepul. DeSepul in this circuit has now recognized, as Judge Pillard has...
Doesn't use that phrase, course of dealing, in DeSepul.
Well, no, because we have more contacts in DeSepul. We not only have a promise to pay where we're located, where they know he's located, but they actually paid him. And the fact that they might have used a courier no different than Federal Express doesn't change the fact. Texas Trading is followed by this circuit 30 years ago, recognized that the realities of modern commerce mean that the use of telex, email at the time, perhaps telephone, means that you act in both jurisdictions, where you initiate the transmission and where it's received. Here they had the intent to issue payments, not just to sit there, but to be conveyed ultimately to Mr. Obiambo, knowing he was in the United States. That's DeSepul.
Thank you very much.
My time to expire.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.